This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Title IX has been around for a while. It states that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Over the 44 years since the law was passed, almost 10 times the number of women and girls are participating in school athletics. The number of coaches? That's another story.
Women coaches are being replaced with men. Men are getting hired over women.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a report on the impact of Title IX on women coaches. We'll also meet a couple of friends who met at Bible study and ended up making lots of beer. And we'll spend an academic minute flirting with disaster. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Title IX was enacted back in 1972. Its intent? Eliminate gender discrimination from educational institutions. It turns out that there may have been some unintended consequences from that law, resulting in an unexpected decline in the number of women holding jobs as coaches at colleges around the country. That's according to a recent report from Reveal, a program sponsored by the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, invited Annie Brown, who reported the story, to share what she learned. Brown starts by getting basic. Just what is Title IX?
We all kind of have this understanding that Title IX is synonymous with athletics. But actually, in the language of the law, it doesn't mention sports at all. It actually just prohibits discrimination based on sex in any educational setting. And so that was then sort of applied to sports a few years after the passage of the law.
You follow a specific story out of Iowa following women coaches who were affected by the change in the law. And I'd like to start with Christine Grant, who was the athletic director for women's sports there in the 70s for several decades. What did she tell you about what the situation for women coaches was like before Title IX?
Right. Christine Grant is this amazing woman. She's actually Scottish and came over to learn how to be a sports administrator in the United States. And she started out at Iowa as the field hockey coach. And at that time, she told me that, you know, women's sports were like a club. You know, you had to pay out of pocket to participate in them. There weren't uniforms. You didn't have money to travel. She said they slept on the gym floor when they would travel, and she drove them around in her car. And so when Title IX happened, a lot of those things that are directly related to resources changed in a major way. But at that time, when women's sports were not funded, only women coached the women's teams. So across the country, 90% of women's sports teams at that time were coached by women. And what she says is that, you know, they weren't being paid. So the only people who were interested in doing this were doing it out of the kindness of their hearts, and that was women.
So what happened when money started coming in?
Yeah, so when money started coming in, so the situation before Title IX is that women's sports really exist in their own department across the country. Most schools have a separate department for women athletics, and that department is run by a female athletic director. Then after Title IX, they have to receive comparable resources to the men's programs. And what happens is that a lot of schools choose to merge those departments, to take the women's department and bring it into the men's department. And Iowa was one of the only places in the country that actually kept a separate athletic department for the women. And that was run by Christine Grant. And in these new athletic departments, what happens is a bunch of new teams are made because now women's sports have to be comparable to men's. So they add a bunch of women's teams. And when they do that, the male athletic director hired just over and above women, he hired men. And so we see this massive drop in the percentage of women coaching women's sports. It drops to 58% in like half a decade.
And this is a national trend?
So nationally we're talking about. But Iowa was kind of this exception because Iowa kept a separate athletic department for their women and they kept Christine Grant in charge of that athletic department. She had control over who was hired for these coaching positions, who got fired, how they were evaluated, how the money was used. And Iowa was really seen as one of these bastions for gender equality. And they were really good. I think under Christine Grant, they won 27 Big Ten titles in 27 years.
So ultimately, Christine Grant decided to retire, and a male athletic director came to replace her. So at that time, were those athletic departments then combined, the male and female athletic departments, when she left?
So actually, a male didn't come in to take over for her. Basically, they just brought the women's athletic department and merged it under the male athletic director. And Christine says, you know, at the time that it was like, of course, she felt like it was 2000. You know, it was like we're sort of beyond this point where they had to really protect the women's teams and the women's coaches. And the athletic director at the time, a man named Bob Bowlesby, she really believed that he had had the best interest of the women's teams in mind.
So then what happened? Because you talk about a coach, Tracy Griesbaum, who was the women's field hockey coach. She had an incredibly winning team.
Yeah, so in 2006, a new athletic director took over for Bob Bowlesby, and his name is Gary Barda. And that's really when things started to shift at Iowa in terms of how many women were coaching women's sports. Under Christine Grant, women coached an average of 80% of the teams during her tenure. This is a super high average when it comes to, like, when we look nationally over that same period, we're looking at, like, 50%, 48%. But then when this athletic director, Gary Barda, took over, within his time there, that number dropped down to 50%. So Gary Barda has been criticized for this reduction in the proportion of women's teams coached by women. And he's also been criticized for the recent firing of the field hockey coach, Tracy Griesbaum, who you were referring to. She was a very successful coach at Iowa, had four Big Ten titles in her name, had been head coach there for 14 years. And she was fired in the fall of 2014 for allegations of being verbally abusive. And an internal investigation at the University of Iowa actually found that she committed no policy violations, but the administration felt like they had to protect their students and decided to fire her. And in response to this firing, there was just an upheaval on Iowa's campus. The whole field hockey team rallied behind Tracy, signed an open letter to the university saying, "Reinstate our coach." Alumni showed up to games with signs that said, "We're embarrassed by Gary Barda." And there was really this sense that something wasn't quite right, that people didn't believe that Tracy could have been verbally abusive in this way, and that something was amiss here.
And you actually went out and tried to find someone to say something that conformed with the allegations that were made against her. How did that go?
Yeah, so I reached out to 60 of her players, and I heard back from 24 of them. And really, none of the women that I talked to before we published the story had anything negative to say about her at all. And really just glowing things, just that she was the best coach they ever had. Many of her players have become coaches, just inspired by Tracy herself. Actually, after we published, one person has come forward and didn't want to go on the record, but confirmed some of the allegations, said that she had, you know, yelled at players, that she had, that they believed that it was possible for her to have called players stupid, and some other of the allegations. They said that they were in therapy in response to her. And so we were hoping to really get a sense of whether these allegations are true. And as a reporter, I can't really say for sure whether or not Tracy Griesbaum was abusive to her players. I just don't know. What I do know is I talked to 24 of her players and they said that she wasn't, and I talked to one of her players and they said that she was.
So, but it seems like the way that your story unfolds, it's tying Tracy Griesbaum's firing back to the merging of the athletic departments, and that the way that the athletic department that is being run at Iowa is not necessarily thinking about who is going to be the best coach for the women's team, and that perhaps they're using these allegations as a way to move people off of their staff that they don't necessarily want there. That was my takeaway from the story.
Sure, yeah.
How did you come to that conclusion?
Of course, yeah. So Tracy's actually the fifth female coach to be forced out in 6 years. And this was really seen as a major trend at Iowa by the critics of the administration. And so part of the claims that Tracy has made in a lawsuit against the university is that she was fired in retaliation for speaking up for the department, that she was sort of known as one of the most vocal female coaches who were critics of Gary Barta. And I talked to the other coaches who were fired, who said that, you know, Tracy stood up for all of us, that there was that, you know, whenever they had something that they needed to bring up, that they could go to Tracy and she would bring it up with the administration. And so Tracy claims that she was fired in retaliation, that it wasn't about these abuse claims. And you know, you have to sort of to unpack this, this idea of whether or not a coach is fired for verbal abuse. You know, one thing that's helpful is just thinking about, like, what if a man was engaging in the same kinds of behaviors, which we don't have any actual evidence of Tracy doing, but let's just say that that's that, that all the allegations are true. And a question that that a number of her supporters say is, you know, would a man have been fired for those same things? And I think that the sense is that men coaches are allowed to be tougher on their players than women coaches are. But when I looked nationally for this, you know, I ended up looking for as many women as I could find who filed a similar retaliation claim against their university, female coaches or sports administrators who filed similar complaints. And basically what these lawsuits say is that the woman was a vocal critic of the athletic department in terms of gender equality. And in response to that, to the woman being so vocal, the university decides to demote her or to fire her. And I actually found 38 of these lawsuits across the country in the last decade. And I didn't really go looking for this trend, but I noticed as I started talking to these women that a number of them had very similar experiences to Tracy, that they were accused of being verbally abusive before they were fired, or when they claimed, no, you retaliated against me, the department said, no, the real reason you were fired is actually because we think that you were abusive to our players. And so actually 13 of those 38 coaches had allegations of mistreating their players lodged against them somewhere in the process of their firing. And so it just it seems like there this is either a trend in female coaches being abusive and being fired for such, or a way that that universities can use these allegations to remove a coach in retaliation.
What I just keep being slightly baffled by is another thing that you uncovered, which is that when the women coaches were replaced by male coaches, that those male coaches got paid more.
Right.
That's the part I keep getting hung up on, that because if you could have really great performance, and this sounds so cynical, but if you could have really great performance and not have to pay top dollar for it, mm-hmm. why wouldn't you
right.
stick with that? Because the teams are not doing as well now, right?
Right. Yeah. So the five women who have been forced out of the University of Iowa Athletic Department, including Tracy, two of them have been replaced with men. And those men have been paid an average of 25% more than their female predecessors. And then for the three he replaced with other women, those women were paid 13% less than their predecessors. And so, you know, the university, when I've asked them this question, and they have pointed to the experience of the candidate, to the peer comparison within the Big Ten. But as a reader, it's hard to, you know, not see that as a significant trend.
Well, you went in and you spoke directly with Gary Barta. Mm-hmm. How many times did you have an audience with him?
Just once.
Once.
Yeah.
So what I found interesting as a listener to your conversation is that when you went in, it was very jocular. Hey, how you doing? And then as you started asking the harder questions, he started sounding much more defensive and mm-hmm. kind of towing the party line.
Yeah.
And one of the areas that you went into was what we talked about earlier, that Iowa had this great record of women coaches for women's teams
right.
in the 86, 90 percentile, and that it's now down to what is basically reflective of the rest of the country.
Sure.
And his argument was, hey, we're still doing great. We're at like 50-50, which is
right.
maybe even better than
right.
the national average.
It is, yeah.
So what was your take on that?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Iowa still is ahead of the national average after this drop. You know, I think that that's I challenged him in just saying, you know, when you compare it to the national thing, yeah, it looks pretty good. But when you compare it to how it's been in previous decades since the departments were merged after Christine Grant retired, it doesn't make sense. You know, I think that was a thing that we were trying to investigate in this story, in this report, was really why has this continued? You know, like in 1970, 1975, 1977, these numbers are dropping. Women's coaches are being replaced with men. Men are getting hired over women. It makes some sense. It's like the 70s, you know, like this was it's still wrong, but like it's not so surprising. What feels surprising is that it's still happening today, and that number, you know, that the statistic of women only coaching 43% of women's college sports teams, the fact that hasn't budged in the last decade, that it stayed right around there, is really what's most baffling. One of the things that it can feel like that we're sort of like at half and half of like, now we have half women coaching women's sports, we have half men coaching women's sports. That's only in women's sports. If you look at sports as a whole, women are not coaching half of sports because they're not coaching half of the men's sports. Because while men have increased in how much in the proportion that they're coaching women's sports over the last four decades, women have remained only 3% of the coaches on men's teams. So it can give kind of a false sense that things are like right, you know, smack dab in the middle. But that's just on women's teams.
Thanks, Annie. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
That was Annie Brown talking about her report, A Man's Game, on Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. She was speaking with Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, produced at KALW. Still to come, when does Bible study lead to beer? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Studying the Bible can be serious business, but that doesn't mean people with their nose in the good book don't appreciate a good time. A few years ago, three men from Atlanta who met at Bible study class started testing beer recipes on friends at Monday night tasting sessions. Well, after 3 years of this, they ended up starting what was at the time only the fifth microbrewery in the state of Georgia, and it's still going strong. Gene Bonner reports.
It's a Monday night in April, and Jonathan Baker is standing over a steel keg, stirring grain for the India Pale Ale he's brewing that night. Occasionally, he pours out some of the unfermented beer mixture to test.
We're rinsing our milled grain in this stainless steel mash tun here, and we're bringing it up to boil here in the brew kettle.
Baker, who works in marketing, started Monday Night Brewing with two friends from his church. One of the friends is Jeff Heck, who says at first they brewed beer just for fun.
We decided, hey, well, why don't we just brew a batch of beer together? We'll just hang out and get to know each other and have a few beers. And so we did it once, and then it was a blast, and we did it the next week. And then the week after that, some neighbors came by, and the week after that, some coworkers came over. And before we knew it, we were doing it on a pretty regular basis, and we were making better and better beer.
Once they decided to open a brewery, they set a target of 2010 to start brewing commercially.
A big part of starting a brewery is having a distributor.
Distribution has been the death knell for other Atlanta brewers that have come and gone. In Georgia, brewers sell beer through exclusive distributors, and it's not so easy to get their attention. So says Dave Gunder of Sweetwater Brewing Company, a successful Atlanta microbrewery that now distributes in six states.
In a smaller brewery or an upstart brewery, you know, they may be in a position where, you know, they're a little bit humble and would have to ask, or in some cases, plead a distributor to carry their product just because they're not a proven entity yet.
The Monday Night Brewing team is trying to learn from other brewers' mistakes. For example, they won't build a brewery right away, Heck says.
Typically, a distributor wants you to have sufficient volume up front to meet the demand. but you don't necessarily know how much it's going to be or what kind of capacity you'd need to have. So so what we're doing is we're actually going to have a third party, another brewer, who has a brewery, brew our beer for us. It's called Contract Brewing.
The Contract Brewer is Thomas Creek Brewery of Greenville, South Carolina. The arrangement will make their startup costs lower. The group has raised money from friends, family, and some investors. Demand for microbrewed beer has continued to grow despite the recession. Joel Iverson, the group's third partner, thinks Monday Night Brewing can help fill a hole in the Georgia beer market.
When you look at so many other states, when you look at Colorado, California, so many other states, there's sort of this plethora of microbrewed beer, and here we're sort of stuck with very minimal local flair.
On that Monday night in April, regulars mixed with first-timers who read a blog the trio keeps about brewing. One attendee, Mark Hermes, is a home brewer.
I'd read their blog for the longest time before I actually came. I said, okay, these guys got an awesome premise going on here, so let me go check it out, and I hope their beer backs it up, and it does, so that's really cool.
In addition to the IPA, Monday Night Brewing will offer a Scotch Ale. I'm Gene Bonner.
So you think you're all good to go when the next natural disaster hits, huh? Well, you might want to check again. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
We might not be as prepared for a natural disaster as we think. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Ann Gordon, associate professor of political science at Chapman University, examines if our preparedness could use a tune-up.
In our national survey, we found more than half of all Americans believe that natural disasters are capable of doing serious harm to them or their property. The vast majority believe an emergency supply kit, such as a 72-hour kit recommended by FEMA or the Red Cross, would improve their chances of surviving a disaster. Nevertheless, 74% have made no effort to put together such a kit. Why? The number one excuse given by Americans is that they expect first responders to come to their aid. This is an unrealistic belief in the wake of a major disaster. Local officials cannot reach everyone immediately, and it could be hours or even days. This means having your own food, water, and other supplies, such as prescription medication, to last for at least 72 hours. Additionally, basic services such as electricity, gas, water, sewage treatment, and telephones may be cut off for days, a week, or even longer. Telling the public to prepare for disaster is an inherently scary message. When confronted with such information, members of the public can respond by trying to control the feeling of fear. There are four factors that are essential for motivating preparedness. 1. Perceived susceptibility. This can happen to me. 2. Perceived severity. This is serious. 3. Self-efficacy. I can actually do something to help myself. 4. Response efficacy. The recommended action would make a difference. We found that each of these factors contributed significantly to the likelihood of preparing for disaster.
That was Ann Gordon of Chapman University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.